WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. At the Earth Summit in Rio, representatives from around the world are trying to figure out policies that would protect the environment while still encouraging economic growth. This is an issue my guest Roger Stone has been studying for the World Wildlife Fund, where he's a senior fellow. Before he was an environmentalist, he was a vice president at Chase Manhattan Bank. He reports on his findings in his new book, The Nature of Development. This project took him to Latin America, Asia, and Africa, looking for examples of what worked and what failed. One of the great failures was an Amazonian settlement in Brazil, created after the world's largest deposit of high-grade iron ore was discovered. Gold was found there, too.
Brazil had always assumed that the Amazon would be the future of the country, in effect. More than half the landscape containing, allegedly at least, vast riches of minerals, of forest products, potential of other sorts that would finally transform Brazil into a great country. So when these discoveries were made, the government back in the 1960s and early 1970s made a heavy bet, made a $62 billion bet, or tried to raise that amount of money anyway, that all this would really come true. As a result of that bet, vast numbers of people began to flock into the area to take advantage of what they perceived would be a bonanza. And some of those people succeeded. Some of them, a few of them, got stable jobs in the mining areas and the hydroelectric dam installations that were put up. But most of the jobs were construction jobs and deforestation jobs that required the use of a chainsaw out in the forest. And what was left after all that phase happened was former forest, now degraded landscape. For ecological reasons, that kind of landscape cannot sustain very many people. It's hard to farm on former tropical forest because the soil underneath the towering trees is very poor. It's hard to raise cattle. And so what happened was that most of the people, once they'd gotten in the area, stuck there without the money to escape, without any forest left to proceed into, at least nearby, were stuck in what became vast failing agricultural and cattle-raising colonization projects, or in the kind of insta towns that grew up around the big installations. And there was nothing and is nothing for them to do there.
Describe what the towns around there are like now.
Well, this town, Parauapebas, started out as a camp for the construction workers who went up the hill every morning to work on what is a very successful iron ore mine called Carajás. When the construction jobs ran out, the workers didn't go away. Other people, in fact, arrived and continued to arrive, and the whole place just grew and grew. When I first saw it, it had only a few thousand inhabitants. Now it has 50,000, and as the Brazilian population booms and as people continue to move in to the area, it's continuing to grow and grow. There's no work for any of those people. They take in each other's laundry. The sanitation conditions, the health conditions, the education conditions in this town are all very primitive. There are no public funds to support it particularly. Prostitution is probably the leading activity among the female population. It just is a dreadful place that never should have been allowed to exist. And the reason is that the planning for the region was all done from outside and from the top down. No one asked those Amazonians, the newcomers, let alone the indigenous populations who inhabited the area before them, what they wanted to have happen to the area. They didn't ask for the dams and the mines and the whatever. They would have been much better off, in fact, if the forest had been allowed to remain in place.
Now, I'm going to ask you to contrast the project that you just described in Brazil with a project in Latin America or one of the other countries that you visited that you think was much more successful because it was better planned and because local people were involved in the planning.
The contrasting example that I would offer comes from northwest Ecuador, a place neglected both by the Ecuadorian government and by the world, where there have traditionally lived a group of Indians called the Awá and some in a town called San Lorenzo along the coast, some descendants of a the slave shipwreck that occurred back at the end of the 16th century. These people farmed and fished tranquilly, although in poverty, up until 1950, when the Ecuadorian government awarded a logging concession to a private company. The loggers came in, employed practically everybody around, and cut down almost all the trees to the point where, in 1980 or so, the citizens, both on the Indian side and in the town of San Lorenzo, began to wake up and realize that their trees were just about gone, that the climate was changing because of the lack of trees, the water supply was in jeopardy. All kinds of changes had taken place in their community, and they worried about their future and what was going to happen after the last tree went, and they began to organize against that eventuality. And they formed cooperatives, they tried to diversify their farming, they began to think of new ways to make more than a very bare subsistence income. And they eventually attracted the attention of the foreign sector. Foreign agencies, both public and private, came in and helped them get themselves organized to face the future sustainably. As of the present time, it certainly is not true that they've conquered all their problems, but they have developed many new programs and activities, education, health, diversified agriculture, and so forth, and they are currently facing the future with a great deal more confidence and security than the people of the benighted town of Paroapebas in the eastern Brazilian Amazon that I previously described to you.
My guest is Roger Stone, author of the new book, The Nature of Development. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest Roger Stone is a senior fellow with the World Wildlife Fund. His new book is a study of development projects and their effects on the environment. I want to get back to your example in Ecuador.
Yeah.
What you're describing in Ecuador sounds like a first step, but it doesn't sound like something really remarkable. Is there something really remarkable that you saw in your travels?
None of these examples are really remarkable, except in the sense that Armageddon has been avoided. Many of the examples that I saw all over the world are instances in which people would have ended up just like the poor benighted citizens of this town of Paroapebas in Brazil, had it not been for certain changes that took place in their course.
One of the places you visited was a development project that included a highway on the Brazil-Peru border. This was funded by the Inter-American Development Bank. In 1987, the bank told Brazil that payments under the loan agreements would be suspended unless there was more evidence that the developers were complying with the bank's environmental provisions. Now, what difference did that make? You know, now that places like the Inter-American Development Bank have environmental provisions.
It really is case by case. There are still instances in which the banks themselves choose to overlook the fact that their environmental rules are not being obeyed. The traditional role of those lending agencies has been to lend money the same way a bank lends money, and its most important concern has been getting those loans repaid. If you or I were to take out a bank loan and tell the banker that we needed the money so we could pay our kids' tuition, and then took that money and went out and bought a fancy car with it, the bank might or might not notice that we had done something different from what we said we were going to do. Probably not. And that's the way that the banks have traditionally felt about these projects. Getting repaid, acting as a traditional banker has been primary. Now it's a little bit different. It's a controversial subject. These environmental so-called conditionalities, to use the jargon, I think are going to have to be applied. I don't think we can afford anymore, given the constraints, the economic and financial constraints on all governments and all people in all countries, we can't afford to send development assistance money to poor countries and have it end up in the president's Swiss bank account. And we've got to develop mechanisms to make sure that doesn't happen. This is not a popular concept among developing countries. What they want is additionality, to add another level of jargon. That is, more money to cope with environmental problems over and above their very basic problems of health and nutrition and education and so forth. But I think that, and I agree that there should be more money but I think that it should come with conditions attached, and I think we should develop the mechanisms to monitor how that money is being used to make sure those conditions are met.
We have representatives of environmental groups and of development groups and governmental groups meeting now at the Earth Summit. Since you have worked in different arenas, I wonder if you think that there are areas in which environmentalists need to change their thinking and areas in which developers need to change their thinking.
No question about it. A lot of what we're hearing currently on the air and in the press is that this is an Earth Summit which will either succeed dramatically or fail dramatically. I don't think it will do either. I think some decisions will be made. Some agreements will not be reached. The importance of it is the convergence of this incredible diversity of people around a set of ideas that are relatively new to the world, tremendously important, and many of them are going to take years and decades even to sort out. But this summit, with all its hot air and all its hoopla, nevertheless serves as a benchmark on which the world is going to build in the future.
So do you think that both environmentalists and developers need to change their thinking a little bit? I wonder what your brief critique of each would be.
Well, it depends on the issue. I think environmentalists certainly needed to learn that you couldn't build fences around forests imaginary fences, if you will, around important marine areas and preserve biological diversity in any meaningful way. Environmentalists had to learn to engage the world. Environmentalists had to learn that the bureaucracies like the people who govern the rules of trade around the world, that govern the flow of public and private capital around the world, are part of the game. They couldn't be ignored. Environmentalists just couldn't put up signs and protest these things. They had to engage at a broader level the society of which they were a part. Development people certainly had to learn the limits of the carrying capacity, to use the ecological term, of many areas, had to learn that the environment had to be a consideration, otherwise the development would fail. They had to learn that it would be important to work with local communities, not just sit around in capitals of rich nations thousands of miles away and draw plans on paper. Development had to learn that this was more than a matter for economists and engineers to decide, sociological factors, anthropological, cultural factors, as well as environmental factors had to be very much a part of the game. I think that to a certain extent, although there are gaps remaining and in some instances wide gaps, that learning has taken place, and I'm encouraged to think of its continuing in that direction.
Your project, studying development and environmental concerns in tropical areas, this project was initiated by William Riley when he was the head of the World Wildlife Fund. Now Riley is heading the U.S. delegation to the Earth Summit in his capacity as head of the Environmental Protection Agency. How do you think he's doing in those roles?
I think he's doing remarkably well, obviously. I think that William Riley, over the course of his term at EPA, has won a few, lost a few. What he has been successful in doing against heavy odds is what I think of as keeping the playing field in the ballpark. In contrast to what happened during the early years of the Reagan administration when everything went anti-environmental, William Riley has succeeded in winning a few, has had to accept more than his share of knocks along the way. But as I say, has at least maintained some decency in the overall environmental profile of the administration. Things would be infinitely worse were it not for his presence.
Who are the villains now in tropical development?
It's hard to divide the world between heroes and villains. Certainly there are some corporations that have yet to learn, as a lot of other corporations have, that economics and the environment are not deadly enemies, that profits and economic prosperity for the shareholders and for the managers of the corporation can only come at the expense of the environment. I think there are lots of companies that still need to learn those lessons, although many of them have learned very well. In a generic sense, the growth of the world's population, and almost all of that growth taking place in developing countries, is what you might refer to as a villain. It's going to be awfully hard for the world to achieve sustainability in the senses that I've tried to describe it without more effective measures to decrease the explosive rate of population growth. I wish this is a subject that we're getting more attention in Rio. Unfortunately, it's kind of peripheral.
Roger Stone is the author of the new book, The Nature of Development. Tomorrow, he's flying down to Rio to attend the Earth Summit.